Okay. So yeah, as I say, we should be fairly informal, so if you have any questions during the talk, feel free to ask them, and feel free to get some more food and drink if you'd like as well. So what I'm basically going to do is I'm going to talk a bit about what I do in my doctoral project, why I've ended up doing that work, the things that it's made me think, kind of the things, the ways it's interacted with my faith, and some of the ways that it could interact, that it could inform our thinking about prayer and learning from past prayers. It's not really a good word for that, but that's the kind of direction we're heading in. So, yes, yes, Jim.
Could you not swallow your words?
Yes, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I do that a lot. Yes, thank you for keeping me up, keeping me right. Okay, so as some of you will know, I work on literature, English literature, both English language and Latin language, from the high medieval period, which is the sort of 11th to 14th in my definition, 11th to 14th, 14th centuries. And I look at literature which is for and about anchorites and hermits, so solitary religious recluses, people who lived alone in order to live a religious life, a life according to a rule, mainly a life of prayer, reading and penance. So this is the kind of the pictures I often use to illustrate what this means. Probably the most famous anchorite of the medieval period is Julian of Norwich in the picture there, who she was an anchoress living in Norwich in the 14th, 15th century. I'm going to Norwich this summer, which is very exciting. I've never been to see her cell before. And then there's also a medieval illustration of an anchorite being enclosed, so being having the ceremony done by the bishop, who's the person on the left, to put her into her cell, because it was a permanent vocation. People entered their cells for the rest of their lives, theoretically, that didn't always work out in practice. The idea of this vocation does shift and change a little bit over time, but the basic idea is that people entered this life in order to pursue the contemplation of God and pursuit of holiness through reading, prayer, and kind of seeking God in a variety of ways. Okay, so my focus in looking at these texts, which are for and about these people, is on prayer, and why is that? It's worth asking. Hopefully it's been obvious I've talked about prayer a lot already. That was part, big part of their lives, but on a kind of on a level of my life, why I'm focusing on that, this goes back to why I've ended up doing this work. So I came to Oxford to do my undergrad degree a few years ago, and that was in English literature, and I wasn't really particularly interested in medieval literature or particularly interested in religious literature as a specific thing at that time. I just loved books, I loved reading and writing, that's why I decided to come. And I was really surprised and kind of challenged when I did the medieval paper that we do here, which we do quite a lot of medieval literature. And I'd kind of got the impression growing up that Christianity kind of took a break between the end of the sort of early church period and the Reformation. And no one ever told me that, but that's often the impression you get in some circles. And so then going and reading a lot of religious literature from, you know, the Middle Ages, surprisingly, you know, these people are so devoted to God, so devoted to Christ, and that kind of surprised me and challenged me and made me want to know more. And part of that is that I looked at a text which I will talk a little more about later, which is called Anchorina Wissa, and it means a guide for anchoresses, female anchorites. It's the one on the left there. You've got a little picture of one of the manuscripts. We looked at this text as a commentary text, so we very kind of delved very deeply into the language, into the ideas, and I just found this lifestyle really intriguing. This is a kind of guidebook. It explains to them how they're supposed to live on a number of different levels. As it's completely away from my experience and from my tradition, but I thought these people are devoted to God. That's the only way you could make this kind of lifestyle work without going insane. So that kind of made me want to know more. And that led me on to a master's degree, which was looking at this text in particular and thinking about various different things to do with it. And the reason, okay, so the kind of paradox or tension that I became interested in as a result of that was that these people are solitaries, they live alone, but that often doesn't mean they're actually alone as such, they're not on their own. In a large number of cases, the norm in the kind of European Middle Ages is people living within towns, within villages, within kind of monastery complexes. They've got servants who kind of do the chores and stuff. They've got people coming to see them, confessors. Some of them, if they're men and priests, may also be confessors and spiritual directors for other people. They're deeply enmeshed in the community, and this is an interesting kind of... It's not really a paradox, I suppose, but it's a tension between this kind of solitary life where they separate themselves from the community and from society, and this enmeshment in the spiritual life of the kind of Christian community in that time. And as I was doing my master's, my supervisor helped me to kind of clarify that this is really about prayer, I suppose, the kind of heart of this paradox. The thing that they're doing is praying. They're separated from society in order so that they can pray more easily, more effectively, and more of the time. But this kind of solitary endeavour is not ever separate from the fact that they're part of the kind of church universal, the body of Christ on earth. And so I think that's become my focus, is thinking about what is anchoritic prayer supposed to be from these texts, and what does it look like? This isn't something that the kind of literary academy has taken a lot of notice of. It's often dismissed as quite a simple thing. Kind of prayer is talking to God. But if you think about it for a little bit longer than 5 minutes, it turns out that it's a little bit more than that. Okay, so that's kind of where this focus has come from me. How do I study prayer? I don't know, maybe theologians could shed light on how they do it in a kind of theological setting. But the main way that I do it is looking at these instructional texts, these kind of texts of guidance. The text is a little bit small, but these are two examples. So Ancora Nuisi, which I mentioned, 13th century, written in early Middle English, although that first bit there is in Latin. And the one on the right is much earlier, so that's from the late 11th century, a book called The Book of Consolation. Book of Consolation, which is a completely Latin text. And they're just two examples of what was quite a large genre, really, in the kind of religious landscape for the number of people which it served. Not only anchorites read them, other people also read them. And they, I think, if you can read that, you probably can't. The emphasis is really, they're not books of lists of rules. So there are kind of guidance, there's lots of kind of little bits of practical advice, particularly in Ancora Nuisi. But largely they're spiritual treatises. They're supposed to kind of inspire them on a broad theoretical level. And they're also very effective, so they're concerned with emotion and the heart, and the shaping of the heart to kind of mould the life of the person. So you can see that from the first line. So this Ancora Nuisi begins with, "The righteous love you. The bride says this to the bridegroom in Canticles, in Song of Songs." So it's concerned with this kind of love relationship that we see in the Bible in Song of Songs. And then... This other one that I've put up there, Gosselin's book, says that introduces the writer as one who is known to Christ and to love, writing to his own soul. And that's quite an unusual one. It's a very passionate relationship that's between the writer and the person who received it. That's quite unusual. I could talk about that for a long time, so I'll stop. So these two texts and lots of other kind of guidance literature sort of are aimed at training both practically and theoretically people to pray, and so they have lots of kind of little bits of practical advice. So Ancora Nuisi has a whole kind of routine laid out for them to follow through the day. Sometimes they have they explore different bits of the Bible that talk about prayer, but often they don't talk directly about it, and it's difficult to reconstruct particularly what that looked like. And I think all that is to say, really, the kind of complexity of prayer comes out for me there as an object of theorization, as an object of study. We can look at routines, we can look at texts that people use, but is that the core of prayer? Like, is that is that really what praying is, the text or the practice? It's difficult to say, and it's something I'm still struggling with kind of defining. So that's one of the kind of difficulties that I face in looking at these things. And I guess that leads to the question of, can we learn from these kind of extreme prayer practitioners as Christians, as prayers now? I sometimes use the term orants in my writing, but that's not very wieldy, so I probably won't. Orants. It's not really a real word, but like to say prayer, like a person who prays, there isn't really an English word, so I sometimes use orant, but it's not really a word. I'm trying to make it a word, essentially. So this is something that Christians often ask me. I had an interesting conversation over the break with people from my home church of, well, why are you looking at these things? I remember one of my friends, my sister's friends, was reported to me as saying, why is Alicia interested in nuns now? She never was before, you know, which is a good question. Why, as a Christian now, not a Catholic, not a professional religious, why do I think these people are interesting in a spiritual sense as well as a kind of dry academic sense? And thinking about this recently, and then I'm going to read a little quote from this book that I've been reading, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Christians, which is a kind of controversial, polemic look at what evangelicals and others today could learn from the kind of medieval past of Christianity, and I recommend it to all of you as a sort of interesting, stimulating read. And the author makes a kind of slightly controversial but kind of striking claim to close to the beginning, where he says, although the Historical Guild warns us against pressing historical periods to answer modern questions alien to their own realities, an approach to history that does not account for its modern relevance may quite literally be worse than useless. Finding moral, intellectual, and spiritual value for our own lives is the whole point of doing history. And Emily bristled at this and did not like it, but it's an interesting, I'm not sure whether I agree with it or not, but I do on one level, and it's because I think that I'm not looking at prayer in the past simply because I think it's interesting, but because it resonates with my experience, and I think there's things to learn. And so how can that be done from these very different, very extreme kind of lives? And I think one way that that I've been challenged to do this is through kind of understanding that it's important to recognise both the alien and the familiar in the past, and especially in the Christian past. So it's very easy to think about these people, you know, enclosed in their little rooms, praying liturgical prayers in Latin mainly, every day, you know, the same prayers for the rest of their lives. Thinking about that's very strange, that's very different to my experience, and is it really necessary? And to kind of recoil from it in that way. But there's also the fact that they are our heritage, our inheritance, I suppose. I wouldn't personally be here as the evangelical person that I am today without that past. It's all kind of connected, if you see what I mean. I'm going to, this is going to come together a little more. And it's a living reality because it is an antecedent of where I am now. So sometimes it's come home to me quite dramatically. Sometimes there are things about the prayers and the practices that I read about that seem to resonate with my experience. So the kind of closeness to the kind of immediate access that anchorites are supposed to have, because they're kind of on a border place between heaven and earth, that kind of closeness to Jesus, very simple address, that seems to resonate with how I was led to pray as a child. But you know, coming to Jesus very simply and asking very in a childlike way, that is something that I recognise, that there's a kind of jolt of familiarity across 800 years. And it's a challenge, I think, to avoid looking first only for people who are like us. So doctrinally, I'm very far away from a lot of these people, but there's a link between them and me, which is factual and historical. They're part of the kind of broad story of the church from Jesus until now. And also there are these kind of little links and little similarities that are very challenging and very encouraging. Okay. So, and I think just before we start discussing, I guess, I'm going to just illustrate briefly why I think this is taking a cue from this idea of connection. It's taking a cue from the anchoritic texts themselves. This is not just something that I think, but also I think that something that is a priority in anchoritic prayer as a practice, as a genre, as it was practiced for many years. I gave a talk a little bit like this one in Michaelmas term, which I titled Medieval Prayer as Time Travel, which was basically to get people to come to the talk because it sounds fun, but also kind of captures something of, I think, of what prayer is intended to do and what it seemed to be powerfully able to do, especially in the case of anchoritic practitioners. So one of the things, this interconnection that I've been talking about, this kind of arises from the awareness in a lot of the prayers that I read and the kind of guidance about prayer that I read in these texts, that the church universal is all, it's a reality. It's not just a theory that we're connected to the saints in the past and the future, the future souls of the church. It's a reality to which prayer looks, which prayer taps into. And on one level, the anchoritic vocation enacts this because it is based on the past in a very special way. So you may know a lot about the Desert Fathers, and this is something that the anchoritic people in the kind of 11th to the 14th centuries, you know, almost a whole millennium later, really looked back to. So these Christians in the 3rd and 4th centuries who left kind of urban Christianity and went out into the desert to live alone, this is something that medieval anchorites consciously model themselves on, which is really interesting. And they kind of see this, they don't see it just as an idea that they've taken and made new, but as a real connection. They see themselves as in the same vocation, the same tradition as people like St. Anthony and all the rest of those kind of desert hermits living alone, even though their lives look hugely different. And often people were living in a kind of metaphorical wilderness, which, you know, a cell in the middle of Norwich is not exactly the wilderness, but that's kind of how people conceptualized it. So that's part of it, is this kind of very living tradition with tradition with connecting them to the past. But also this kind of flowers in a real connection. So they receive the intercession of the past. That's very apparent in all of these texts, and they give mutual support in their contemplation, in the fact that they're living and praying as they do every day. That spreads outwards to the whole kind of church across the world and across time as well. And I'll just give a little illustration of this from a little section from the text I talked about, Ankara Nawissa. And this is a little bit where he's expounding a verse from Psalm 101, which is actually Psalm 102 in the Bible that we use today. And so he says, David compares the anchoress to a nightbird that is under the eaves. So the verse is, I've become like a pelican in the wilderness. I've become like a nightbird in the house. The nightbird in the eaves signifies recluses who live under the eaves of the church. This is referring to how cells were often in kind of just attached to a church wall. They'd often have a little window through so they could see mass. So live under the eaves of the church so that they may understand that they ought to live such a holy life that all holy church, that is Christian people, can lean on them and be supported by them, and that they should hold it up with their holiness of life and their blessed prayers. And so here, the thing that I find interesting is that prayer seems to kind of cross space, as we understand it to do. It's not limited to the community in which they live, but into the all holy church, that is Christian people. Like, you know, the anchorite living under the physical church is expanded out to be a support for the entire church, kind of metaphorically. But also metaphorically in the sense that it's real and not false. And then he goes on, that is why the anchoress is called an anchor, and anchored under the church, like an anchor under the side of a ship, to hold the ship, so that waves and storms do not capsize it. Just so, all holy church, which is described as a ship, should anchor on the anchoress, for her to hold it, so that the devil's blasts, which are temptations, do not blow it over. Every anchoress has a commitment to this, both because of the name of anchoress, and because she lives under the church, as if to prop it up, if it should begin to collapse. She never stops. The anchor house and her name are constantly proclaiming this commitment, even when she's asleep. Furthermore, the nightbird flies by night and gathers its food in darkness. In the same way, an anchoress should fly by night towards heaven with contemplation and with holy prayers, and gain food for her soul at night. And here I think So we've got two metaphors for prayer, as you can see. You've got for prayer and the praying person. So on one level, it's a kind of stable weight, a kind of anchoring presence, a foundation for the church being under the eaves. And then also the opposite, being like flight, being like a bird that comes out of the kind of nest of the anchor hold and goes out to kind of feed, to gain strength for that kind of anchoring process. And I think it's interesting, this is the kind of centre of it for me in Ankara Nawissa, is that it just pushes at the boundaries of how things normally work on Earth, I suppose. So this first paragraph is interesting to me because it says that the Anchor House and her name are constantly proclaiming this commitment of prayer and holiness, even when she's asleep. So how does that work? We don't really pray when we're asleep, surely. But it's this kind of idea that the whole life of the Anchorites becomes prayer because they're so devoted to it. And so its efficacy, its kind of effect on the body of Christ, the church, carries on just kind of continuously by nature of being an Anchorite. And then in the second paragraph, talking about going at night, we sort of get the Anchorite disrupting the normal earthly cycles of time. Night is no longer for sleep, it's for prayer. The night bird is sort of flying out into God. All these things are kind of underwritten by God's continual presence. You know, God is like the sky in this metaphor, right? That the bird goes out into. God is like the kind of the sea, I suppose. Maybe not, actually, because it's the waves. But I'll think about that later. And so there's this kind of idea that the Anchorite stands a little bit aside from time and therefore can care for the church outside her normal, her kind of earthly setting. And that's something I can expand upon a little bit later. That's only one example. So this is both, you know, this is communal and personal. So someone praying in private, praying at night when no one else is awake, but also holding up the whole edifice of the church throughout history as she does so. So try and wrap this up. How this works in my mind now is that our kind of connections and our debts to the Christian past are always more live and real than we're perhaps tempted to think. Prayer is between us and God, but also it's never apart from the body of the church, and apart from the people who've done it before us. These people prayed with the understanding that the church would last forever. And that's very apparent in how they pray and how they dedicate their lives, I suppose. Giving up their whole life to something that will last forever, I think, is often the idea behind it. And that's something that encourages me, and it encourages me to look to the past for models. Maybe not models that I take in every way, because I'm not an Anchorite, so you can see that I have not taken it literally. But to look for a real connection, for saying people believe this, and I still believe this, and so there's a real connection there that enlivens prayer beyond just me in this moment now with God, to God overseeing the full span of time and seeing all the prayers of his people rising like incense across time. Just to kind of finish off, this is kind of how I'm filtering this through is through T.S. Eliot, the 20th century poet. And he expresses this really well. So in his play The Rock, he says, "What life have you if you have not life together? There is no life that is not in community, and no community not lived in praise of God. Even the Anchorite who meditates alone, for whom the days and nights repeat the praise of God, prays for the church and the body of Christ incarnate." And slightly later on, he talks about, it's a play about church building, which maybe gives you context for that. Talks about the temple forever building, this kind of body of Christ. And he talks about people seeing the past, the dim waste plains of the future where the temple is still to be built. So you may remember the lives that await their time to be born, to be dedicated on the dim vast plain of the future, burning as lonely lights. And I often think that for these people in the medieval past, that's what I am, a life awaiting my time to be born, a lonely light in the future. But they gave their lives over to the understanding that would be part, I would be part of that tradition. Maybe not me personally, but you know, Christians today would be part of that tradition, and that is something that I think is not simply interesting historically, but also powerfully informative of faith today. So there we are. That's kind of the end of what I'm going to say. We'll maybe have a break for kind of get drinks and stuff, and then we'll have a discussion. I've got some various questions about prayer, and if you have any queries specifically about that, you can ask me as well. So thanks.